Good evening, everyone. And, lovely to see so many people with an interest in listening to the Dhamma. And I'm very interested to hear some of you and to have some discussions, questions and answers or whatever at the end of the talk. So I'll try not to talk too long so that you run out of steam. At the age of 17, I took what I told my parents somewhat disingenuously was to be a gap year before university. And when year became two, and I never went. So I went to India. I hitchhiked most of the way to India. I've been fascinated with India and Indian culture and Indian religion as far as I can remember. And I particularly remember one morning, it's been January 1976, and I was standing by the side of a road somewhere. A gentleman came up to me. I imagined he was a civil servant, and he said to me, "Good morning. And, what is your country?" So I said, "England." "And what is your concept of Godhead?" And I just thought that was so wonderful. You know, that someone who just you'd never met before would just come up to you in the middle of the road and ask what my concept of Godhead was. You know, and so, of course, being, you know, just 18 years old, so I didn't have a particularly sophisticated concept of ultimate reality. And it was, seemed to me that he was more interested in telling me his concept than of listening to mine anyway. So I listened to him. Oh, this is what I love about India, where the spiritual and the mundane exist in a kind of seamless relationship. And fast forward 30-something years, and just before leaving Thailand, I was in the house of an old lady who was to be accompanying me on this trip. She was unfortunately ill. And she was watching television, so cable television, and I wanted to skip forward to see whether the typhoon in Japan was going to hinder our travel plans. And so I was channel surfing, and I stopped upon this American channel. And it was a young lad of, I don't know, 17, 18, or maybe, or something. And it seemed to be, he seemed to have been successful in some kind of a competition, talent show or something. And the interviewer said, "How do you feel?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. I'm just having trouble processing reality right now." And I was so impressed by that. No, I just couldn't imagine how I would translate that into Thai, or how, or imagine any young Thai person of my acquaintance who would, in a moment of excitement, would express itself as having difficulty processing reality. So my conclusion is that with the economic progress of India, the rising of India as an economic power, I think that the spiritual side seems to be waning somewhat, but the bright side, the silver lining of the cloud of American economic decline might be teenagers who worry about processing reality. And so an interest in life. This for me is the heart of Buddhism. Buddhism is not a teaching which wants to give you cut and dried answers and telling you you should believe this and you shouldn't believe that, but is encouraging you to ask questions about life and not just the details of life or the worldly projects in which we get so easily engrossed and enmeshed, but in the very our very humanity and what we're doing with our lives. It's often we just so busy going from this to the next thing and the next thing to the next thing that we never really stop and ask ourselves, well, why, what for? And this is why it's so important to have a daily meditation period. It's very appreciative of the invitation to all of you just now. I encourage you to take the present up on that, because irrespective of any spiritual progress that you might make as you would usually conceive of it, just the very effort to make some time to stop and to be with yourself as a human being rather than yourself as a student or as a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a son or a daughter or a husband or a wife or whatever. Having a time which you put aside every day, it's a time just to relinquish for a moment all your conventional identities and worries and anxieties. And when you do that, I think that you'll observe that as your mind calms down, even a little, then things start to bubble up. Things, yeah, this is really not a wise thing that I'm doing right now. Or I really should spend more time doing this and doing that. And those kinds of thoughts, you know, are not to be dismissed as an obstacle to meditation per se, but they're also indications that we're having a little bit more communication with ourselves. And there's the sort of exponential growth of our capacity to communicate with others engulfs us, then there seems to be a corresponding lack of communication with ourselves. And there are so many ways now in which we can distract ourselves. And in our lives, I think the dilemma or the conflict between something which is quite obviously noble and that which is ignoble, that which is good, that which is bad, occur relatively infrequently. But what does bedevil us is the draw towards the superficial and the trivial. And so we've seen huge trivialization of our lives, I think, over the past years, and how much of what we say, what we text, what we email is really conducive to our long-lasting benefit and happiness. The Buddhist teachings are encapsulated in a very simple phrase, which features in most Buddhist ceremonies. And the phrase is, for the welfare, for the happiness and for the welfare of all sentient beings for all of time. Or we could say sustainably for the sustainable happiness and welfare of self and others. The Buddha is pointing to the need for us to give attention both to the outer and the inner, but also to be creating happiness and welfare of others, in the families, the community, in the society in which we live. The transmission of Buddhism to the West has been one in which the meditation techniques have been emphasized, and quite understandably so, in that skillful means of training, educating, cultivating the mind, been pretty well discarded in Western culture, or completely neglected, particularly in the Protestant culture. So it's quite natural, and I myself and many of my fellow monks came to Buddhism through this interest in training the mind. But to consider Buddhism as a solipsistic, internal, individual project is to seriously misrepresent the Buddha's teachings. In fact, at the time of the Buddha himself, the word which was most commonly used to refer to this teaching was the Dhamma Vinaya. So the Dhamma is all those teachings focused on inner development. And the Vinaya is consists of all those teachings intended to create the optimum environment for the practice of Dhamma. So many of you may have heard the word Vinaya or Vinaya, and perhaps assume that it's a term restricted to the monastic discipline. This is not the case, but the Buddha established the monastic order specifically to provide the most conducive environment for the study, practice of the teachings and the propagation of them. But nevertheless, he, in what ways he could, given that he was living in a non-Buddhist culture and one in which there were some shared values but many conflicting values, he laid down precepts or suggested precepts and conventions in the world in such a way as to enhance or support practice of Dhamma as much as possible. So the Buddhist teachings, the Eightfold Path, are abbreviated or summarized and called the Threefold Training of Sila, Samadhi, Panya. And this word, the Pali word, is Sikha, which can be translated as Sikha, but as training. But also it's a wider meaning is indicated by the fact that in Thailand, in Thai language, the word for education is Siksa, which is directly derived from this word. So we can refer to the Buddha's training as essentially a system of education, an education of conduct, an education of the heart, an education of our understanding of life. And this is not a step-by-step education or training, but it is an organic or holistic system. That is to say, the training of sila, or for want of a better word, morality, then the training of the heart and the training of understanding is supportive or is standing behind it. So it's in that particular area of life, the sila education takes precedence or is in the limelight, but is backed by and supported by samadhi and the banya elements. In the training of the heart, the sila and the banya trainings are supportive. They're standing behind it, they're informing it, they're enriching it. And similarly with the banya, or the wisdom, the development, understanding, then the sila and the samadhi are also present. To illustrate this, I would like to expand upon the training of sila. A sila, or morality, in Buddhism is not conceived of a number of commandments. The the word, the Pali formula, which some of you may have chanted yourself or have heard chanted in the precept-taking ceremonies, like Panatipata Werapmani Sikkhapadang Samadhiyami, first precept to refrain from taking life, from harming and hurting others. The last two words, Sikkhapadang, so it's a pada, means a subject of or area of education. Samadhiyami means to undertake. So translation is that there is, I voluntarily undertake the education of my conduct with regard to other living beings. I undertake the education, the training to refrain from hurting and harming. So there's no reward and punishment, there's no carrot and stick here. It's important, it can only be sila if this training is undertaken voluntarily. So if you refrain from hurting others, killing others, well, wonderful, that's an admirable thing to do. But if you're only refraining from hurting others because you're afraid of the reaction of those around you, or perhaps of being punished or going to prison or even going to hell after you die, then it's not sila. That's not Buddhist morality, because it lacks this essential feature of a commitment, voluntary commitment. So the wisdom element here is that you have to see the suffering for oneself and for others inherent in harming others, and the value and the nobility and the beauty of refraining from harming and hurting. And similarly with the other precepts. Now, not only do these precepts have to be taken on voluntarily, but they also have one's attitude towards them has to be protected from gaining ideas or any sense of self-aggrandizement, or perhaps a desire or hope that by keeping leading a moral life, then after death we'll go to a heaven realm. You know, that's not to say that keeping the precepts will not lead to rebirth in the heaven realm, but that the desire for that result tarnishes precept, the keeping of the precept. There is also a very memorable discourse in which the Buddha said, if you keep precepts purely, and on the basis of your moral purity, you consider yourself superior to someone who doesn't keep most moral precepts, your sila is thereby impure. So being proud of purity is impurity. So it's not, I don't want to do this because I'm afraid of punishment, right? That's not what Buddhist morality is at all. It's a training. And the keeping of precepts requires a number of virtues that need to be cultivated on a regular and consistent basis. The most obvious, I think, is that of mindfulness. And I don't think that it can be stressed or emphasized enough that you can't just be aware. Just be aware. You can't. It's not possible. You have to be aware of something. You have to be mindful of something. And the degree to which you clarify your object of mindfulness, or the skill with which you make use of what I would call pegs for mindfulness, you know, are the guarantee of success, both on the moral plane and in the more subtle internal levels, planes of the practice. So how do you, you know, in this busy, overwhelming world, sensual overload world, where there's something crying out, calling out, pleading for your attention all the time, and where the external features of your world, which are encouraging you to live well and wisely and kindly, are far exceeded by those things that are encouraging you in every possible way to live unwisely and heedlessly. How do you establish that sense of awakeness, awareness, presence of mind, clarity of mind, good judgment? And initially, the recollection of precepts is a most valuable tool. So in any kind of social situation, making a clear determination that whatever happens, I won't lie, I won't cheat, I won't exaggerate, I won't conceal, I won't speak harshly, I won't speak divisively, I won't try to set people against each other, I won't gossip about things which drain people of their goodness and energy and stimulate all that's dark and mean in their minds. And so by making a firm determination in that way, it's not that the determination in itself is effective, but it establishes a standard, it establishes an aspiration and a channel for your mind. And if it's right there in the forefront of your mind, then in daily life, you're constantly recollecting it. You're coming back to yourself. You're coming back to the present moment again and again in a very effective way through mindfulness of precepts. So it's not that Buddhist morality is the precursor to meditation, but it is in itself a form of spiritual development. And we learn so many things by keeping the precepts. I think it's sobering, quite frightening, actually, when we start to be very honest about how honest we are in our speech, how often we like to think ourselves as basically honest person, don't we? But then the number of times we compromise on the truth of our statements because we're embarrassed, because we want people to look at us well, we don't want people to look down on us or to lose their respect for us. We want something from somebody. I'm afraid if we tell the truth, we won't get that thing that we want, whether it's a material thing or some kind of mental reinforcement. The effort to be completely truthful is a very intense, purifying practice. And we notice that, the kind of frustration that lay Buddhists smell now, oh, I don't have time to meditate, there's just so much going on in my life. That's really beside the point. Now, on this topic, I would like to suggest that a good framework for understanding this Buddhist education is expressed, understood in terms of the framework of what we call the four right efforts. So that's one factor of the Eightfold Noble Path. In the threefold abbreviation, it's considered to lie within the category of the training of the heart. And there are four elements. The first is the effort to protect the mind from unwholesome, negative, toxic mental states. So that needs a vigilance, a heedfulness, a clarity, a precision of mind in every situation. But it's almost impossible that we're going to be completely successful with that effort. So we also have to be ready and to be committed to strategies of reducing and eliminating these negative, toxic mental states that have already arisen. Then we also put effort into cultivating, creating all those positive, noble, uplifting mental states that have not yet arisen in our hearts. And lastly, to cherish, to care for, and to further develop all those positive mental states which have already arisen. Now, I would suggest that if you look at your life, whether it's a very busy life, our extremely busy life, that it is still possible, whatever your circumstances, wherever you are, wherever you're with, to put one of those four kinds of effort into place where at any time, at every time. So you're going into a meeting, and there's perhaps one particular person going to be there, a board member or a colleague or a friend or an acquaintance, and is someone who you find really obnoxious, a really irritating person. And the natural kind of feeling that arises, oh no, today I've got to go into a meeting and I've got to sit through so-and-so and put up with the things he or she says and does, and you just feel drained and depressed and fed up before you even get into the room. But with this attitude, you say, okay, what's my practice today? You know, what usually happens in this kind of situation? Well, I get irritated by this irritating person. That's what happens. And so you say, well, my intention today, my spiritual practice today is to protect my mind and not allow myself to be irritated by an irritating this irritating person, because it's not fixed and inevitable. Now, in the physical sphere, if a totally immoral or amoral monster was to put a human being, I'm speaking figuratively here, was to put his hand into a fire, you know, his hand would burn. If any of you were to put your hand into the fire, it would burn. If a fully enlightened Buddhist master was to put his hand in fire, it would burn. Because this is the nature of fire, the nature of human skin, it's like this. And so we could say that whenever this human hand comes into contact with flame, it will burn. But we can't say that whenever the human mind comes into the presence of or into an irritating person, it becomes irritated. It's not fixed, is it? We can see this simple matter of observation that the degree to which we become irritated or angry or jealous or anxious or whatever is not fixed. It's not the same level of intensity every time. There are so many other factors which come into play. We might, one day we might be in a really good mood for some reason, and the person perhaps seems a little bit comical, or, you know, we just don't worry about it too much because we're in such a good mood. On another day, we might be in a really bad mood or feel really insecure. Someone's just criticized us unfairly or demeaned us in some way, and so we're already very sensitive, and this time this person's words are especially irritating. And then we notice that just as our own response varies through the influence of various causes and conditions, then different people have different reactions, and that some people can be in the presence of this but not be irritated by them at all, may find them quite kind of lovable, eccentric. Here he goes again, you know, isn't he cute when he starts behaving like that? So a lot of Buddhist practice in this way is observation, learning to observe what's going on and what's going on in your heart, and to see that there's no fixed connection between an external trigger and an internal mental state. These things are conditions. They're not the cause. The cause of any human suffering always lies with ignorance of the way things are and its attendant craving, craving to get, to have, to become, craving to get rid of. So we can see this in our daily lives. We say, oh, you look sad. What's wrong? Oh, today so-and-so just made me so upset, or I'm so hurt by what somebody said. Somebody abused me, or today I met someone who showed racial prejudice towards me, or so on. And so this is why I feel this way. But in actual fact, that's not the case. I mean, that was a condition. It was something which invited anger, invited hurt, invited fear, invited anxiety. But there has to be, you have to receive the invitation. There has to be something coming from you together with the external trigger. So this is not a teaching saying it's all inside, you know, you just make your heart peaceful and calm and wise and everything will be all right. No, it's recognizing the influence of external conditions and being able to let go of any negative reaction doesn't mean that it doesn't that that's all right. If somebody is to treat you badly just because you have a black skin or a yellow skin or a white skin or a pink skin, your first job is not to suffer because of that. But secondly, next thing is you need to report that person or you need to do something about it. So equanimity is not the goal, but it's the path. Wise action, which leads to this sustainable happiness and welfare for self and others, always springs from, grows from equanimity. And we don't have this idea of righteous indignation, or you have to hold on to your anger, otherwise you just don't want to do anything. I think that's a mistaken idea and leads to a lot of unnecessary confusion and suffering. But the mind which is equanimous and bright and clear and alert is the mind that has a very clear and unbiased discrimination of what should be done right now, what needs to be left for a while, what should be spoken, what should be left unspoken, what should be said and done, not said and done. The mind which is free from anger and prejudice of any kind is the mind which is ready to act in the best possible fashion. The angry mind is a coarse, one-sided mind which buys into this whole idea of us and them, the aggressive and the aggressed, the right and the wrong, the good and the bad, and so on, and just tends to make things worse. What the value of it is just for a while, you sort of feel good at letting off steam. That's about the extent of it. So, going back to this example, now these four right efforts, you know, are based upon this idea that there is nothing fixed. There is no mental state which is part of or expresses who you are. And one way I like to talk about the mind, well, and the body, is to say that in Buddhist understanding, there are no nouns. There are only verbs. Everything's a verb. Even the mind is, seeing the mind is a verb rather than a noun. There are things that are rising, passing away according to causes and conditions. For that reason, we have to be constantly awakening and brightening the mind and clarifying the mind and strengthening the mind, because even though right now there may not be coarse negative mental states, we can't guarantee the future. Only the stream enterer, one who's realized the first level of enlightenment, who can guarantee their mind is going to be free of negative mental states independent of circumstance. And any student of history will have observed how the rules are suspended, and a lot of the things that would earn you life imprisonment or a long period of incarceration in peacetime can earn you medals in wartime. When the external supports for wise and kind living are removed, many people who in peacetime would have lived a completely normal and conventionally moral life become awful, nasty people. And when things change, then unless we have this inner discipline and inner training, we just get swept away by that. And one of my best friends married my sister, and we used to play soccer together and close together. And he was at school. He was always greatly inspired by Mahatma Gandhi. So After I left home, and I didn't see him for a number of years, after I'd been in Thailand for some 6 years, I returned to England for a visit. By this time, my sister and her husband had two children, And we were sitting around, and I said, are you still inspired by Mahatma Gandhi and Ahimsa and the nonviolence movement as much as you used to be? And he said, oh, yes, absolutely. But if anybody came near my kids, I'd kill them. So, you know, this is it. You know, we always have these exceptions. And, you know, there are certain circumstances where, yeah, we're not really sure. And, you know, in a time of famine, in a time of civil war, so, you know, when you felt unsafe, your loved ones were unsafe, everything can change. So, but although that kind of extreme situation may not hope that does not appear in your lives, the point I'm trying to make is that this effort, this inner discipline, and this skill, understanding the way of the mind and developing techniques and methods to protect the mind from the arising of mental toxic mental states is fundamental to this Buddhist training, and that the effort and the techniques in the discipline of learning how to eradicate those that have arisen. This is what it's all about. A very simple, straightforward example. One of the antidotes for anger and aggression is loving kindness. And people can get a little bit sort of discouraged with this, you know. Yeah, it's all right to have, you know, you feel loving kindness for all sentient beings, all the universe, you know, and I love everybody, you know, except for him, you know. Except for, and it's usually someone in the same house that's the problem. And, or, you know, you meet somebody and you said, yeah, I know you're supposed to have metta and loving kindness, but this guy is just so obnoxious. You know, I just can't do it. I just, you know, the very thought of wishing him happiness, you know, it's just like, you know, he's already got all this stuff and I give him happiness as well. You know, it's not fair. So, but the point about metta or loving kindness, is that we wish people well. So be specific about it. So if someone is really selfish and self-centered, egotistical, then what can you wish them? You can wish them, may they be free of selfishness. May they know the happiness of putting other people first. May they transcend this narrow, miserable attitude that they carry around with them all day. So, you've changed your, you, it's not that you're sort of living in this, delusion, you know, love everyone, you know, cause you don't and you know it, but, and that's all right. I mean, it's completely all right. But what you can do is that I'm not going to dwell in aversion for this person because it's hurting me more than it's hurting them. And by just change, yes, may they be free of that habit, of that kind of personality. May they know the happiness of freedom from that. And I think that's something that's very practical and applicable in any. So it has to, you have to start off, you know, with what really works, rather than, you know, what you think should, you know, a Buddhist or a meditator should be. You know, don't get into that. Buddhists get ill, you know, and I should be able to deal with this better than I can, or they get sort of fearful and anxious and think, I shouldn't be like this. I should be peaceful and calm. Or, it hurts. You know, I'd like pain medication, but that would be sort of letting the side down because meditators have to be tough and deal with pain. So this isn't kind of some kind of macho show for other people. You don't have to be anything very special. You just be honest with yourself and learn from experience. And so, like in daily life, I was saying the other day, like walking through an airport or on a busy road, just do this loving kindness meditation, but very, very specific. You see someone who looks really kind of, tense, and may they be free from stress and tension. You see someone who's very overweight, you say, may they be free of any suffering because of their weight. And try to think up something kind and specific for people that pass by. And rather than feeling stressed out, you can really feel very, very good and peaceful. So taking one step at a time, and so just as making this effort, we're not safe from negative mental states. It's easier for the mind to go downstream than it is to go upstream. But also, there is no beautiful, noble mental state which cannot be cultivated within your heart. This is a teaching of the Buddha. Sometimes we put up spiritual teachers on a pedestal. They're so wonderful and peaceful and holy and wise. But these teachers are just vessels. Now, when you say, "Oh, I feel so much devotion," say, or inspiration with, let's say, the Dalai Lama, for instance. But what is it really? What's really going on there? What we're really inspired with are the compassion, kindness, forgiveness, integrity, and so on, that we see within him. He's someone who embodies these qualities, makes them real to us, and inspires it. We're inspired by those qualities that we see within him, rather than the Dalai Lama himself, and same with any teacher. And there's not one single virtuous quality embodied by the Dalai Lama or by any great teacher which cannot appear and grow and thrive within any one of us, man or woman, young or old. And so we have this effort to cultivate the good and the kind and the and to cultivate patience and kindness and compassion and mindfulness and inner peace. It's difficult, very difficult, but it's worth it. I don't know of any great monk or nun, any great teacher who would look back on a lifetime of effort and said, "Oh, what a waste of time. I wish I hadn't, it wasn't, what a disappointment." Far from it. I think it's very few people who don't experience that sometime in their career, but spiritual teachers don't. Yeah, every single breath, every single drop of sweat was worth it, because you can see how it truly leads to one's own welfare and happiness, and also the ability to create and stimulate happiness and welfare in others on a sustainable basis. So these beautiful qualities arisen, and we can't take them for granted, because if we don't look after them, they can disappear. And there's so many monks, nuns, meditators, put a lot of effort, received some fruit from their practice, rested on their laurels, and now I've done it, now I've got it sorted out, I'm beyond this, I've transcended that, everything's wonderful. And they just little by little, drop by drop, disappears. And they wake up one day and say, "How did I get here? Where did that all disappear to?" And it's very common in spiritual life. Overestimation of one's attainment and lack of interest and commitment to caring for and furthering one's spiritual attainments. These are perpetual themes in Buddhist history, and I'm sure in the history of any spiritual tradition. The Buddha himself asked about his practice directly prior to his enlightenment, said there were two qualities which he felt were most instrumental in his enlightenment. One was unremitting, steady practice in all postures. And secondly, perhaps surprisingly, discontent with the attainments his realizations that he was already enjoying. So the Buddha, you know, without a teacher, without a framework, an external framework, without anyone encouraging him, still had within him this pushing onwards and onwards and onwards, never taking anything for granted. So these are some of the reflections that I would like to share with you today, and the ability to be mindful, to be aware, and to be awake, and to be wise in daily life is greatly supported, enhanced by daily meditation practice, but also putting forth effort in every posture and every situation. And when we do have time to meditate, then meditate. And you don't have to do it for, it's not a big thing. During the meditation, I was saying, look on it as enjoyment. So, you know, you say, oh, let me go and meditate for half an hour, you know, I'm going to concentrate on it. It's like kind of a bit of a burden, you know, you're already sort of thinking, shall I or shan't I? I could do something else. Maybe I'll just go and lie down or go and send a message to somebody. look on meditation as enjoying your breath. Say, I'm just going to go into my room for 10 minutes and just enjoy my breath for a few minutes. That's quite a good feeling, isn't it? You know, and where's Sansa? Oh, he's just enjoying his breath for a few minutes. He'll be back. You know? So turn off your communication devices. Have times of the day when you're incommunicado. I think this is a word which we need to bring up and revive, uphold, incommunicado. I think that would be a really good sort of Latin phrase on that. Put up on carved into the stone here somewhere. So having times when no one can get in touch with you and you're just in touch with yourself. And in meditation, what are you doing? You're putting forth these four efforts. It's not anything that you're enjoying, but in order to enjoy the breath, you have to be skillful in preventing hindrances from taking over your mind. You have to know how to deal with hindrances that have arisen, consciously bringing up what we call the enlightenment factors of meditation, or the jhana factors, all these technical terms, basically bringing up all that's wholesome and beautiful. And when those things are starting to arise, taking care of them, taking them further and further. So daily life and meditation, this is just different sides of the same coin. It's just one thing. It's a seamless practice leading from darkness to light and from bondage to liberation. So thank you for your attention. So don't know if you need to, anyone who needs to stretch their legs, otherwise I'm happy to answer any questions or listen to anyone's ideas.
I have a daughter who's about to be four, and one thing we've incorporated into our morning routine and evening routine is 1 minute meditations. And so what I've asked her to do is just sit still and try to be quiet for 1 minute, which is difficult. But is there anything, one idea I'm playing with is for her to try and listen to her heartbeat or something to focus on. Do you have any suggestions for a three-year-old? Which I am also sometimes a three-year-old.
I think for small children, the meditations that immediately engage the emotions are very good. And loving kindness meditation, and you can do that even with a small child for longer than a minute. And just encourage them to think of their loved ones, mummy and daddy, and just think of, close your eyes and think of your mummy's face smiling and happy. And you think, may mummy be happy, and think of daddy, and think of him smiling, think may daddy be happy. And then you can be guiding a little. Okay, let's spread loving kindness to mommy, to daddy, and to grandparents, and to friends, and then to all the people in Palo Alto, or all the people in California, and all the people. And you know, as you get older, you can do it more, and then you can do, you know, all the rabbits, all the puppies, all the polar bears, and you know, and you can be a little bit creative. But although whatever sending this kind of loving kindness can vary in its object, it's just developing this ability to send this sense of well wishing to others. So I think with small children, you know, not really expecting too much kind of silence, but sustaining a positive, uplifting emotion through reinforcing every few seconds or few minutes when the child starts to waver and become distracted, and seeing as the child gets older, how much if it makes it too long and the child starts dislike it, and that's not obviously with any kind of teaching, you want the person to feel it wasn't quite long enough, you know, like doing a bit longer. Another technique in the secular mindfulness groups in England, I don't know in the States whether they use this technique, but it's rather nice, is to use the breathing, but to use your finger. And so breathe in, and you reach the top of the in-breath, and you breathe out. Breathe in, and then end it at the top of the finger, and breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. So you synchronize the breath with the movement. So it's something to do as well. I think that's a nice one.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Often when we talk about mindfulness, the word translates from the Buddhist to the English, not an exact translation. Often people think of thought patterns and training the brain, but from what you're saying and what I've heard from many Buddhist teachers, it's really understanding and being present with feelings, emotions, everything. It's not just like the abstractions of the brain and thought patterns. Could you please comment on that?
Well, sati, this is the term sati, means recollection. And in its particular function or expression, is dependent upon the object of sati. So if the object is in the past, you know, it would be probably most effectively translated as memory or just ordinary recollection. You know, you said, well, what did we talk about just now when we were having a cup of tea? And you bring that to mind. That's sati. That's recollection. And the Venerable Ananda was the monk declared by the Buddha to be foremost in sati, which is surprising in that he wasn't an arahant. He wasn't a fully enlightened. He was a stream enterer at the time of the Buddha's death. But he was given this title as being foremost in sati because he was the one who memorized and could recollect all of the discourses of the Buddha. So that function of sati is prominent in the Pali discourses. But when the object is present in the present moment, then sati means not forgetting. This is a tip. When a good way of trying to understand these technical terms is to look at what they're not, or the opposite of them. So this is why mindfulness in the Eightfold Path is included in the training of the heart rather than the training of wisdom. It's not a wisdom faculty. It's a heart faculty. So if you're with your breath and you're not forgetting your breath, then you're mindful of your breath. So whatever you take as an object and you're able to sustain attention, not forget it, then you're being mindful of it. Now, mindfulness works in conjunction with another mental factor, which is called sampajanya, usually translated as clear comprehension. And this is a preliminary form of wisdom. So if if you're meditating on your breath, say what you're actually doing is you're sustaining mindfulness on your breath. You get distracted. You lose sati. You've forgotten the breath. After a while, what's happening? This isn't my breath. This is not leading anywhere. This is a waste of time. That's sampajanya. See, this recognition that this, what I'm doing right now, i.e. thinking, fantasizing, is not what I set out to do. It's a departure from, it's a deviation from. And through that act of mindfulness, you reestablish attention. This is like vitakka. You put the mind on the object again, and you reestablish mindfulness. So you can be mindful of a particular body part or a function of the body, the breath. You train yourself to be mindful of feeling. Because there's always a feeling in every moment of consciousness, either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And we seek to bring that to mind and to be mindful of feeling. So we tend to lose focus in the presence of neutral feeling because it feels like nothing's going on. We attach to pleasant feeling, we push away unpleasant feeling because we're not aware of feeling as feeling. And similarly with mental states and hindrances of the mind, which I've been speaking of to a certain degree already. One of the teachings which we can easily overlook because it seems so straightforward, the Buddha says, recognizing a hindrance as a hindrance. You know, what does that really mean? I have an analogy. Let's imagine someone who was born into a slum, a terrible, horrible environment, and never had the opportunity to go anywhere. All ever known was life in a slum. And then one day, some kind person takes a person out of the slum, out of the city, up to a mountain, top of a mountain, trees, breeze, fresh air. And what happens? The boy, the girl thinks, wow, where I live, that's a really nasty, dirty, smelly place. And prior to that, even though living in that environment, there'd been no sense of that because there'd been nothing to compare it to. But through that first-hand, direct experience of something that transcends that, in a sense, oh, that's so dirty, that's so smelly, that's so disgusting. And so although, you know, we hear that this kind of desire, this kind of aversion, this, these are hindrances, we can grasp that intellectually, but we don't feel it. And that's why it's so important to develop a meditation where, at least for a short while, you have an experience of a mind which transcends hindrances. And you say, oh, this is peace. And that mental state that I indulge in, that's really unpeaceful. That's really toxic. That really pulls me down. And before you never realize, it's just who I am. I'm like this. You know, this is who I am. And you say, no, it's not. So, you know, one of the reasons why this whole kind of distinction or division or argument about this is samatha, this is vipassana, you know, this is just this and this is that, I don't really think it, you know, it's that useful because if you're doing a pure focusing technique, let's say on the breath, for instance, the experience of peace, of samadhi, transforms your whole understanding of yourself and your role in the world and your desires and aspirations. Your whole value system can change. So, to say, well, that's not really developing wisdom. You know, it's not looking at arising and passing away. It's not a vipassana technique as though it's something inferior. I mean, I don't think that really is a very helpful way of looking at things. You know, say, well, what's the effect on your life if experience if you can digest and reflect skillfully upon the experiences of meditation, you can learn something that then is expressed in your daily life. And the more you are mindful, then the easier it becomes, and the more you see that, yeah, it's true. Like you've been told since a kid, real happiness lies within. You don't, you know, we pay lip service to all this stuff, you know, but when it comes to the crunch, we don't really believe it. You know, unless you've experienced this inner happiness, you don't really believe it. That's why it's so important to develop this practice internally. In most Asian languages, certainly in Pali, Sanskrit, and in Thai, Chinese, as far as I know, we just have one word, is jit or jitta. And in the Western languages, then we have this division into the heart and the head. And, you know, for a long time, it was a major headache or heartache for translators, you know, knowing how to translate this term, because when you translate the jitta as the mind, then people tend to take the cognitive intellectual aspect and overlook the emotional aspect. And when you translate it as the heart, then people assume that you're excluding the intellectual side. So there's never really been any resolution, but a convention has been adopted that we use the mind. But that includes everything that also comes under the heart in English language or in most Western languages. But I think that there is nevertheless value in making that kind of distinction when you understand it's, you know, it's a conventional distinction. And certainly, I think one way of talking about meditation practice is that it provides a bridge between the mind and the heart, as those things are generally understood in Western culture. So if as I mentioned just now, it makes real the value of the training. And Western Buddhism in particular has been, you know, been plagued by this over-intellectual approach. I mean, because Buddhist teachings are just so emotionally intellectually satisfying, that often people can just stop there. But the Buddha spoke about wisdom as being one of the most well-known of his presentations. The subject of wisdom is that there are three levels or three kinds of wisdom. So the first is wisdom of accurate, beneficial information. Okay, you going back to the example of the fire, somebody tells you, you know, if you put your hand in the fire, it burns, and you remember that. And on the basis of that information, you don't put your hand in the fire. So that's the first level of wisdom. You hear teachings from the Lord Buddha and great teachers. You remember them, and they start to inform how you live your life, your values, and so on, your decisions about what and how you spend your time. So this is one level of wisdom. Second level of wisdom is taking information from here and from there and integrating it and reflecting on it and taking it further. So these first two kinds of wisdom are what form basis of most education systems. The third kind of wisdom is called bhavanamayapanya. And this is the wisdom that comes through meditation and when the ability to take the mind beyond the thought world. And having a new dimension of experience, a perspective on thinking. And when the mind stops thinking, but is at the same time intensely bright, alert, alive, then a new kind of wisdom, and a wisdom which affects radical changes in your life, appears. So we can hear a Buddhist monk says, look, we're all going to be separated from everyone we love. Okay, I don't think anyone can quarrel with that, can they? Think of anyone you either, you're going to die before they do, or they're going to die before you do. There's no other alternative. Oh, well, I guess you could die together in a plane crash or something, but let's not go into that. But you got the gist. So, that's true. Oh, yeah, whatever, that's really true, you know. But then, you know, you are bereaved for some, you do experience some awful separation. And the question is, what value to you is that knowledge? Is that assent, that intellectual acceptance? Yes, that's true. Not very much, I think we would all agree. And for that reason, this we could say, yeah, it's still in your head, it's just in your brain, it's just a thought, a perception, but it hasn't been fully digested and fully experienced and understood. And this is, so we can say it has to engage both the head and the heart, so we can say that. My view, and I would suggest that meditation, you know, is the way to effect that integration and inward digestion of these simple truths of life, which we hear and we think we know, but really it's very superficial and it doesn't really reach the deepest parts of our life.
I think since it's already 8:40, if there's no more question, I would like to conclude the event. So, on behalf of Thai Student Association at Stanford, I would like to sincerely thank Venerable Ajahn Jayasuro for sparing your time to come and visit us at Stanford and taking your time to teach at Tama. We believe that we would like to, we'll learn what you have taught us and then make more efforts to be aware of the factor that could affect our mind. We'll try to learn to let go better, and we'll try to, to eradicate any negative toxicity in our mind. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Before you all go, this is rather kind of abrupt. I just want to tell you one of my favorite stories. It's just a very short story, but it's one I like a lot. So this is monk, and he's walking, and he's walking towards the mountain, as monks do. And he lost his way, as monks also do sometimes. And there was an old lady sitting by the side of the road, and she's doing some work or other. And he says, Grandmother, excuse me. How long will it take me to get to the mountain? And she's just carrying on what she's doing, pays no attention. And she says, Grandmother, could you tell me how long it will take me to get? She's, and being a Buddhist monk, you said three times. So he said, Grandmother, excuse me, how long will it take? And she, so he walks on and just assumes she's deaf or didn't. And she, a few meters down the road, and she says, 3 or 4 days. And he looks back and he said, Grandmother, why didn't you reply when I asked you? She said, well, I had to see how fast you were walking and how sincere you were before I could answer. Okay, so thank you very much.